For the week of April 7th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 188, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And parked at the cemetery, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, wow.
Everybody's dead. Everybody.
Oh, man. What a way to start the show. I mean, we take last week off, not accidentally, but it certainly wasn't a planned vacation. It was spring break, and I had to go to Disneyland, take the kids.
Sperling.
Yeah, it was all my fault, actually. I will admit to that. It was all my fault. I had to go to Disneyland with the girls, and they had a great time. I certainly wouldn't want to go back during spring break anytime soon. But I think we have a story later on about how Disney is laying people off, right?
That's true.
Yeah, I don't necessarily understand why they're laying people off, because they seem to be making money hand over fist there.
But while you were gone, everybody died.
I know. I've noticed that.
Everybody died. Annette Funicello just died a few minutes ago. I just found out about that. My sister told me. I didn't even notice that. So if your mom wore a tropical print dress, she's probably sad that Lily Pulitzer died. If your dad grew up with the Mouseketeers, believe me, he's heaving a little sigh over the fact that Annette Funicello just died. Margaret Thatcher in England died, of course. She was probably one of the least liked figures by people in the arts community. Around the world, not a friend to the arts, Margaret Thatcher. Whatever you thought of her, not a big champion of the arts. So really disliked, not appreciated by anybody, I think, in the arts.
No, but on the other hand, Roger Ebert, movie critic, was one of the most loved.
Absolutely true, as we saw this week, and I think those are going to be some of our guests.
That is true. On today's show, we'll be talking to Ann Thompson from IndieWire and David Poland from Movie City News, who are two entertainment journalists that they knew Roger Ebert over the years, as did Michael and I, and we will all share some stories about the man many are calling the most famous movie critic in the world. We'll also talk about the announcement that Jimmy Fallon will take over The Tonight Show in 2014 after NBC effectively forced Jay Leno out. We kind of mentioned this a couple episodes back.
Effectively, they fired him.
When I wrote that word effectively, I thought to myself, I know Michael is going to stop me right here and try and delete.
We're not renewing your contract. Go away.
Yeah, pretty much. That's exactly what they said. We'll close with some inside baseball about the court ruling, which has left many broadcasters worried about their retransmission fees. We even have some listener email at the end if we have enough time. This is going to be a longer show. We've got 2 weeks worth of news to get through. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world is G.I. Joe Retaliation. It grossed $61 million worldwide. It made $231 million so far and counting. So off to a very strong start for that franchise. It opened last weekend to very good numbers, and it's still doing quite well around the world. At number two around the world is an animated film, The Croods. This movie's done very well. It's from, of course, DreamWorks, being distributed by Fox. It grossed $55 million around the world. It's at $332 million and counting.
I'm sure all those animators laid off over at DreamWorks Animation can rest easy knowing that their work is actually popular.
That's right. They've almost tripled their budget already. So this movie is doing very well for them. It's definitely the launch of a new franchise. And number three is the number one movie in North America. Worldwide, it's number three. It's Evil Dead, a remake of the classic horror film. It made $30 million. So that's quite good. I think its budget is something like $17 million. Yeah, $17 million. So, when you can almost double your budget in your first weekend, you're doing all right.
Well, and that was mostly in North America, $26 million in North America, because it only opened in 22 territories. So it's got a ways to go. It's going to make some money.
Absolutely. Also, whether this is making a lot of money or not yet, I think the jury's still Oz, the Great and Powerful. That has made $21 million worldwide this weekend. It is now at $454 million and counting. That's a lot of money, but of course you have to remember it costs $215 million to make.
Well, make and market.
Well, no. Market is another $100 million. It's about $315 million to market.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all the toys...
It cost over $200 million budget, is what a lot of people are saying.
Well, I can tell you, having been to Disneyland recently, that they are just pushing the heck out of that movie with all of the paraphernalia that you can buy.
Did you buy any of them?
I did not, no. Nor did I buy the, and I know this is way off topic, but, we've talked about how Lucasfilm was purchased by Disney for $4 billion back in November. Well, it didn't take them long to figure out that, hey, if we just put the R2 helmet, the top of the R2-D2 head, just stick some mouse ears on that, we can sell those mouse ears. There were kids all over the park with those little R2-D2
so
mouse ears.
Instead of mouse ears, they were R2-D2 with mouse little ears on the top of it, like a R2-D2 skull with the mouse ears on top of that.
Right. And then there was the Yoda backpack and the Chewbacca backpack. I mean, they can't make money fast enough at that place.
I wonder who was selling them before that.
I have no
idea. Lost all that business. Anyway, at number four, is it? Is no, one, two, three, four, five. At number five is Jurassic Park, the reissue. When I'm wrong, I'm wrong. This did much better than I thought it would. It grossed $21 million worldwide, including $18 million in North America. It's a reissue of the classic Steven Spielberg film, reconfigured for 3D. It was the third biggest opening weekend for one of these reconfigured movies. Number one was The Lion King, and number two was Star Wars The Phantom Menace. So Jurassic Park off to a very strong start. I don't know how long it'll go. It comes out on DVD and Blu-ray in 2 weeks. So there's a very short window for this one. I know people who saw it, and they thought the 3D was dumb and pointless. So I don't know how much they spent, $10 or $15 million probably?
Yeah, probably around $15 million.
Yeah, so money well spent, I guess. They didn't spend a lot to market it, I imagine. Looks like they'll probably make some money off that one. But does that really help the franchise a year or two from now if people see it in 3D and think it's lame?
I doubt it.
Yeah. At number next is Olympus Has Fallen.
I like the way you've like totally lost track of like
what
number one.
Well, I'm looking at these charts now that we get from RentTrack, and they don't have numbers. So I sort of...
It's number six, Olympus Has Fallen.
I have trouble with math. this movie opened how many weeks ago?
Oh, like three?
3 weeks ago, yeah. It made another $12 million worldwide. It's at $80 million and counting.
And it's only open in nine territories, so that's actually
well,
got
no,
a ways to go.
It's in nine territories. That's not a running total.
That's true. You're right.
So we don't. It's hard to track how many countries movies have opened up, and it's always hard for us to figure out. You can sometimes know, oh, it definitely hasn't opened in Japan or China or Australia or UK. You can know some of the big territories, but it's really hard to track that back and forth, that ebb and flow. Right below that, Olympus Has Fallen, at number seven is Jack, the Giant Slayer. Another $10 million, but it's at $178 million worldwide. It is pretty well tapped out, it looks like. I don't know if it opened in China yet, but it's in 61 territories this week. It's only at $178 million. It was very expensive to make. This is clearly not going to go into the win column.
No, as a matter of fact, I think that there are some accountants over at Warner Brothers that are trying to, squeeze some red ink out of someplace because they need all the red ink they can get for this particular film.
Right next is Tyler Perry's Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor. That made another $10 million. It's at $38 million and counting. This movie probably won't even be released overseas, but since he makes his movies on a dime, it's probably profitable already for everyone involved.
That's
following
true.
That is The Host. That's the film based on the novel by Stephanie Myers, the author of the Twilight series. That grossed $8 million. It's at $32 million and counting. Essentially, in North America, but a little bit overseas, but mostly in North America. I mean, it's made $20 million in North America, and it's in a few countries overseas. So it's at $32 million. The movie costs $40 million to make. So now you have to wonder, if you had Twilight expectations, is this film a hit or is it a flop?
It's a hit.
Why is it a hit? It didn't make anywhere near what Twilight made.
Yes, however, they only spent like $2 to $3 million to purchase the rights, the North American rights. So
you're saying the distributor in North America made money?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the people who made it, if they could only get $2 million in North America, the idea is open it in North America, let it be a hit, so it's worth more overseas, right?
Well, partly, yes. I mean, but then remember...
Well, why else sell it for just $2 million? I mean, that's pretty low.
Well, because it's only North American rights. So you're not getting you know, Latin America or Asia or Europe. You're basically getting...
You're getting the biggest market in the world.
Yes, one of them.
The single biggest... No, it's the biggest film market in the world.
Yes, it is.
Right? Right? And do the North American people get video? Do they get DVD?
Well, let me look at the contracts here. I'm going to go over...
Probably?
Probably, yes.
Right, so $2 million is really low. So the guys who bought it for a dime in North America, they're making money because they certainly didn't spend a lot of money to open it.
No,
maybe they had a commitment in their ad budget. That happens a lot now. They say, okay, you give it to you for $2 million, but you got to spend $20 million to promote it.
Yeah, that's what happened with that. Oh my goodness, I can't remember his name. All of a sudden, Don John's Addiction, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's movie. He directed it, and it was at Sundance. And now it's, by the way, only called Don John. And it was purchased for $4 million, but with a $25 million guarantee in print and advertising.
There you go. So that really helps the movie's profile down the road. Well, so it's a hit for the people who bought it in North America. It's probably a flop for the people who created it. And it's certainly not the beginning of a franchise anywhere near like the Twilight series. Right below that is Identity Thief. That's overseas for another $7 million.
And that's at number 10. I should.
It's at $157 million and counting. At number 11, Dragon Ball Z. Did we talk? This opened last week, I think, so we haven't discussed it yet.
No.
It grossed $4.4 million. It's at $18 million and counting. Dragon Ball Z is a long-running franchise, but it's been about 17, 18 years since a movie came out in this franchise. It's based on a manga, I believe, isn't
yes.
it? It might be a video game, might be a manga. I don't even know anymore. But it's a long-running series, hasn't been around in 17 years. They just released an animated version, and it's doing pretty good overseas. In Mexico, there was a nice big hit comedy, Nosotros los Nobles, or The Noble Family, went wide last weekend, and that made a lot of money. We can't track how much it's doing in Mexico this week, but it was a good, solid launch for that film. Maybe we'll see it in the U.S. And in limited release, last weekend you had a good hit, the Ryan Gosling film, The Place Beyond the Pines. That's from the director of Blue Valentine, I should say. And a couple other movies did well in limited release this weekend. They are Shia LaBeouf. He has some good news because Robert Redford directed and starred in the film The Company You Keep. And Shia has had a rough time on Broadway where he left a show. But at least he has a new film that opened strongly in limited release.
And then he like went to the opening night or something like that and sat in the front row or...
That was at the Broadway House. That was at Orphans on Broadway.
All right.
Yeah, he went to a ticket to... He bought a ticket to cheer the people on.
Oh, okay.
And they were like, why are you here?
Right. Didn't we fire you?
Yes, so that was unpleasant, but there you go. So yeah, he has good news with this movie. So The Company You Keep, a new film by Robert Redford. It's just limited, 4 screens, 29,000 per screen average. We'll have to see how it does next week or down the road. Trance, the new film by Danny Boyle, that also had a solid opening on a few screens. Again, you got to wait to see how it does down the road.
Well, and Wreck-It Ralph, believe it or not, in 14th place, $3.4 million, must have opened somewhere. It was playing in 69 territories this past weekend. And it's made $467 million to date. Obviously, it just came out on DVD and Blu-ray here in the United States, but overseas and in different territories, it's still playing. It made $3.4 million. That thing still is racking up the money.
There you go.
And where is Brave? Where is the Academy Award-winning Brave, I might add?
What do you mean?
Well, it's not here.
Well, it made more money than Wreck-It Ralph did.
Okay, fine. I'm just still upset that Brave movie won.
Oh, God, I didn't like Wreck-It Ralph, so I'm glad it didn't.
Michael, you know who we sound like here, don't you?
Siskel and Ebert.
Siskel and Ebert, that's right.
We wish.
Yeah, well, we're sitting here debating whether Wreck-It Ralph was better than Brave, even though Brave won the Academy Award. That's exactly what Siskel and Ebert did. Of course, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two of probably the world's most famous movie critics. Gene Siskel died, I think it was in 2006. I can't remember when he passed away, but it was of a brain tumor. And this past week, Roger Ebert passed away after a long battle with cancer. And joining us to talk about it is Ann Thompson from IndieWire and the Thompson on Hollywood blog over at IndieWire, and David Poland, the editor of Movie City News, two people who knew Roger Ebert and had met him over the years. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sad we're here for this reason, but happy to be here.
I was going to say, I think one of the things we realized this week is that everybody knew Roger Ebert, or everybody felt like they knew Roger Ebert. You know, he was so many people felt that he had engaged with them.
Well, now, yep. David, you said you weren't necessarily shocked that he had passed away, even though Roger Ebert had come back from, I guess, several bouts with cancer. But you felt, I don't know, you said episode one was your eulogy to him, or your obituary of saying goodbye to Roger Ebert. Why episode one? Is there going to be an episode two?
Yeah, there'll probably be an episode two that's actually sitting there on my desktop now, and an episode three, maybe a four, who knows? It's hard, you know, it's weird for me because I am one of those, like Anne, who have a cancer and post-cancer relationship with Roger. You know, it's been a long time. Roger is one of my earliest supporters when I was on the web and, you know, was on a show and things like that with him while he was still talking. And it's not that the people who've known him since his voice was lost aren't, you know, part of his life in the same way, but it's a different a different experience. And I'm being very careful. I'm reading a lot of stuff out there that is deifying Roger in a way that I think he would be unhappy with a little bit. You know, he loved his image, but he also was very much about being real and raw. And
I think that's very important.
Over the top.
Huh? I think that's very, very important. He was honest, especially after he lost his voice. It was as though, having looked at death in the face, he was absolutely beyond vanity. He didn't care if people saw what he really looked like. You know, he had lost half of his face. It was disturbing to see it in person. You could sort of look right through him in a way.
Yes, well, literally.
It was quite a life-changing experience. Because, I mean, one of the things, again, it's awkward for me because you don't want to talk ill of the dead. I don't think it actually is talking ill, but I think you don't want to, like, you know, be gossipy or whatever. But, you know, Roger was very, very structured before this all happened. He had very specific, you know, he didn't want to change things he did. He was very, you know, straightforward about, he wanted to stick with his path. And when this happened since the Esquire cover, I guess, you know, he really, it changed him in a way that is profound. Because the choice to be that open was not Roger, you know, 15 years ago. To be as, you know, completely transparent is a new, you know, is Roger 3.0. And
although,
it's wonderful, but it's different.
One thing I would argue, though, David, is back in the day when he was on Siskel and Ebert, and one thing to remember is that show, that television show, that review show, which was allowed to be a lot smarter than a lot of the subsequent ones have tried to be or have ever. There are no other successful shows like this. There's Siskel and Ebert, and then Ebert and Roper were the only ones that were truly successful. And I would argue that to the extent that he was able to be honest and vanity free in that context, even if he had a huge ego, which of course he did, but what he really cared about was sharing how he felt about movies. That was the overriding passion, and I believe that made the show as successful as it was.
Well, I would argue that having Roper on the show was a destructive force to his legacy and his career, and to film criticism in general. As the man who's a very nice man in many ways, but was never a film critic, and was kind of, there were a lot of reasons why he got that job that had nothing to do with being a film critic. And I think that actually Roger's illness, went from what was a, you know, a downward slope with Roper, to a, you know, a level of importance and significance and honesty that, we've not really seen in film criticism, and that we hadn't seen from Roger prior to that.
I agree.
I would say that the Ebert and Roper was half successful. But David, we all know how important he is. Tell us a story about what memories popped up for you and Roger that people, you know, personal memories that people haven't heard or don't know about.
Well, for me, Roger is about the bawdy jokes. You know, for me, Roger, the time you could see the light go on Roger's eyes when he was busting Siskel's chops, which, you know, even like in backstage at the Oscars, where, you know, Gene would kind of wander around like a hyperactive child looking for celebrities to touch. And Roger would be there at his, you know, his computer typing away like a, you know, like a guy on deadline, even after all the success, all the money, everything else.
I loved him for that.
He loved that battle. But also when he would tell a dirty joke, which he often did, or, you know, sit around with people and shock them. That was a great joy to him.
I remember him at Cannes. There was some, and a lot of people got to see more of him at Cannes. There was this, I think it was a Robert Altman movie, and there was a party at the Majestic Hotel. And I happened to be at the Roger Ebert table. And that was the one time I really got to see him regaling a group with his stories. And he dominated the whole table the whole night. He was hilarious. We were all melting with laughter.
That's a very common story about Roger Ebert, that he did kind of have this funny side to him. And, you know,
it was dirty. It wasn't just funny. It was like he liked
it. Bawdy is the right word. Remember, he wrote the screenplay for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the Russ Meyer film. You know, he was into that stuff.
And that's not something that's actually been, you know, I've read a number of obituaries on Roger Ebert. And we should say, for those of you who don't know, a film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times for 46 years.
That's the least necessary introduction you have to do.
Okay, well.
But, you know, one of the things about Roger and the Sun-Times that is critical and was part of his big part of his life, he wrote every single review for the Sun-Times for many years. And it was he was very proud of it and very serious about not giving that up. That he wrote every review. He didn't have help. And in the last few years, there have been a few more people getting bylines. But for at least 20 years, he was the only person who wrote every single review.
And you know what, Michael, you say it's not necessary, but I remember in, I want to say 2002, Roger was, I was in a press conference in Cannes, and Roger Ebert was there for Mystic River. And he began to ask a question at the press conference, and it was more of a statement, and it went on for like 2 minutes of him talking and standing up and talking to Clint Eastwood and everybody on the dais. And all of the foreign journalists, not knowing who he was, said, you know, started kind of chanting at him, you know, ask a question. None of the American journalists did that.
Well, you talked about his writing, David, and I think lost in all the mist of his great popularity on the web and the way he's reached out in so many different platforms and adapted to Twitter and adapted to a blog, I think what's been lost a little bit is his writing. And we all know he won the Pulitzer Prize very early in his career for his film criticism, the first film critic to do that. And I think his writing is a little undervalued, frankly. If you look at that 70s and 80s, especially those 20 years when he was writing so much material, I think his ability to stay fresh and engaged and write cleanly and enthusiastically about movies is pretty remarkable. You can go back to almost any review and be immediately engaged and caught up in what his enthusiasm and excitement or putting down of a movie might be.
Well, there's an
element
to Roger.
I agree with you. Very well said.
There's an element to Roger that's a bit like being a movie star himself in that, you know, how do you separate Clint Eastwood from a performance? You know, if Clint Eastwood gives a great performance, people just go, oh, he's just playing Clint Eastwood. And I think the same thing is kind of true with Roger in that he became, the stardom really was about television. You know, the Pulitzer was great, which he was the only one to have at all for 20-something years. But, you know, really people knew him because he was a TV star. He was a guy who you connected with on television. And the writing outside of Chicago was really a different thing.
And I would disagree slightly, David. I think he was a national print critic in a way that most local print critics were not, partly because of the TV show.
Well, but you actually say in your piece, Anne, that no critic will ever be as famous again. And that's a quote. And you also say that he reached the mainstream. So what do you think film criticism, where do you think it goes from here? I mean, certainly now everybody with a pen is a film critic because of the internet. Is it possible for another Roger Ebert or another Gene Siskel to arrive?
That's my argument, is that it is not, and that he was the most famous film critic who ever lived, and he will remain the most famous because A, the television show won't ever happen again. I just don't see it happening, and B, even someone like Vincent Canby in his day at the New York Times or Pauline Kael at the New Yorker, when they were writing about movies were really important and they had a national stage. That doesn't seem to be true anymore, even for someone like A.O. Scott or Manola Dargis. They're really not, they don't have the impact that the critics of the New York Times used to have. And I don't think anyone does.
But those guys were never as famous as Roger. I mean, in our circle,
I agree with
of people
that too.
who care about these things, yes, you know, Pauline Kael is God for some people, all that. But, you know, television is the great equalizer. And the reason that there's never been another Siskel and Ebert is because Siskel, it's funny because the David Carr piece, which in many ways is terrific, but, you know, he talks about kind of Roger and Gene putting together this show. Well, they didn't have anything to do with putting together the show. They were two guys who happened to be in town and somebody came up with the idea and they were put together. And this magical thing happened between them. That became the impetus for 20 plus years of television, where they were, you know, like the characters in Gunsmoke or like the characters in, you know, Seinfeld, were indelible. They were perfectly matched. They fit.
It's casting, chemistry.
Again. You could have a moment.
But they
like
were genuine
again.
Rivals. That's why it worked. They were.
Well, there are many
fact.
Reasons why it worked, but the idea that you can't like just make that chemistry happen by putting two people in a room together. It may happen again, but it won't happen because Disney, you know, came up with a solution and came up with two hosts that they like together. It's not Kelly Ripa and, you know, and Michael Strahan. It's a different kind of magic.
But when you saw all the different, I mean, you were a guest host, I was a guest host. When you see all the different combinations of all the different people that went on that show during the period of time when Roger was recovering, you could just see that it was impossible. And I agree with you that with Roper, it wasn't nearly as good as it was.
Well, it's not likely. It's not impossible. Yeah. I mean, nothing is impossible.
You know why? Because they will be. It, if you're too smart, it doesn't work. And if you're too stupid, it doesn't work. If you're too old, it doesn't work. If you're too young, it doesn't work. You know what I mean? It just won't have the demands.
Well, but we don't know what that combination is.
I
think you're right for the most part, but I also think that, you know, one of these days, I mean, the number of kids who are on YouTube that get a million hits for, becoming stupid, you know, at some point, some combination of people, some critic, some
It'll
person
online,
may have
though.
The charisma, may have the moment, may fit the era. You just never know. You don't know
It'll
what television will look like in 10 years, much less criticism.
Yeah, and
I think it won't be movie critics. It'll be TV critics, because I think TV is where the quality and the art and the discussion has moved from feature films, because Hollywood
true.
Is just not the center of arts anymore the way it was.
I think that's a media focus, a media-centric notion.
What about video
I
games?
I'm with you. I mean, if I'm any example, I would rather watch television than watch most of the movies that are out there today. And I think that's true of many, many, many adults, smart
it's true
adults.
Of everybody over 35 and has been for the last 100 years.
Then why are you disagreeing with it?
Because it's not changed. Television is not, film is a medium that has been made in terms of commercial cinema, is made for people under 30, has been for since Jaws, since before Jaws. That's
that
the demographic
simple.
That goes to the movie theater a lot.
It's not
people
that
over 30 don't want to go out so much. They don't want to pay money to go to the theater.
I disagree with that
too. They're 65 again and they have time. But that's just that's a demographic phenomenon more than the quality of film or the quality of television, in my opinion.
I would disagree with you wholeheartedly, because I think that the studios have abdicated for the most part, making the films that would pull those people into the theaters. If you look at the stats from the MPAA, the most frequent moviegoers are adults.
No.
And they are
moviegoers are under
and the ones who not anymore. And
always.
The ones who are no. And the ones who are the ones who are the most fickle are the young male demo. They're the ones who are falling away and declining now.
But the numbers just don't add up in that regard. That's a falsehood. It's just not true. That if you look at the biggest movies, there's still teenage boys who are going to those movies. It's not It hasn't changed that dramatically. And if you look
at the
numbers,
studios haven't stopped aiming at them. The studios haven't stopped
say
making
that, then
movies
last year
for them
we had,
because
the
they're easier
Award,
to
year,
sell.
Had movies that were aiming at adults that got big business.
Yeah, they're still doing
the
adult movies for the end of the year. And they're figuring out that the demo is adults. They're not in complete
but
idiots.
The demo's not adults. It's never going to be adults. It's not the way it is. People who are over 30 and under 60 don't have the time to spend on movies. Or television that much either. They have other things going on that require their focus.
Unfortunately, the studios agree with you and believe that your conventional wisdom is saying is true. And therefore, they've stopped making movies for those people except
they stopped making movies because television started making movies and television took over drama. And the studios will continue to make dramas as they do. They'll have to make them more cheaply than they did for a while. DVD screwed up the cycle much more than anything else. Because there was so much money in DVD. Of course, this has nothing to do with Roger Ebert, but there was so much money in DVD that they made everything for $100 million. And you can't do that and keep your business now that DVD is gone.
Actually, that does bring up a part of Roger Ebert's legacy I'd like to focus on that I haven't heard discussed much. And that's DVDs and Laserdiscs and letterboxing. For me, Roger Ebert really educated America about pan and scan, about the crappy visual images on VHS and what a joke they were, how you could watch an Astaire and Rogers musical in the theater, and then when you watch on VHS, instead of seeing both of them dancing, you only saw Astaire or Rogers and the camera cutting back and forth. I had no idea when I was a 14-year-old kid, and he really taught me what a scandal that was. And I think he constantly lambasting the studios for what they would do on VHS and then DVD in the early years. And I think he educated America and really made letterboxing cool and just an essential thing that the studios wouldn't have even bothered with. And I felt like he was one of the big prime movers to educate America about letterboxing and tout the great picture quality of Laserdisc and then DVD and help those mediums become what they are today, which is a great way to see movies if you can't get to a theater.
I think you were correct that Roger was one of the great format champions of all time. And he was fighting, you know, he used to fight for 48 frames a second as well.
Did he? I didn't know that.
48 frames, yeah. That was one of his big things. It was a company that did a higher higher number of frames, and he was a big champion of them for a long time. At the festival, he's always shown, until recently when you couldn't get them, formats like 70 millimeter, even Todd AO Vision. They found a projector that had Todd AO Vision. Could you show Todd AO Vision?
That's at Eberfest, where I used to go for a number of years, and you've been a person on that festival panel for a number of years, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was always the opening and closing of the festival was a format. Originally, it was called the Overlooked Film Festival.
Right.
And the idea was overlooked films. And so format was always one of those things with him. However, that said, I'd say the reason letterboxing is now, you know, accepted is because of the TVs we have in our houses, not because of Roger. You know, he was a great champion of formats and keeping people thinking about these things. But like so many other things, commerciality and money ultimately defines these things. And the fact that we all have now 50-inch and 60-inch televisions in our homes allows letterboxing and a lot of other things to be real.
Well, you know, I'd like to say that to me, Roger Ebert was always very good at knowing what was next. So he was very active on Twitter before it became extremely popular. And, you know, one of the stories I like about Roger Ebert the most is comes from Cannes, where we would often run into Roger along with Sundance and other film festivals like Toronto.
Telluride.
That's where I would hang out with him.
Right. And there was one year, and I want to say it was 2005, I was going to see a screening of at the director's Fortnight, and it was a screening of Factotum, and we wound up sitting next to one another, and there were a whole bunch of us journalists kind of hanging out. We were all talking back and forth, and somehow we started talking about how it is that people find our writing, and it was mostly, you know, online, and this led to everybody mentioning Google. And that's when Roger told a very interesting story, and he said that in 1997, he found Google online and thought that what they were doing was fantastic. He said, wow, they're really trying to index all of the world's knowledge. This is a fantastic idea. And Google was, at the time, had just started. They were not a household name. And he reached out to the company and said, look, I really like you guys. I want to buy stock in your company. I want to support what you're doing. And he heard back from these two guys. One was named Sergey Brin and the other was named Larry Page. They were the founders of Google. And they told him, look, we have no plans of going public, okay? But we really like your reviews. We know who you are. And look, if you just send us $10,000, we will allow you to buy stock if and when the company ever goes public. And Ebert took this huge leap of faith and sent them the money. He wrote a check for $10,000 and sent it off to Sergey Brin and Larry Page. And he then turned to Chaz, his wife, and he said, look, realistically, we will probably never see a dime of that money again. Consider that money like lost in a gambling debt or something. It's gone. We're not going to see anymore. 7 years later, Ebert remember him saying he was shocked to hear back from them when the company was going public. He heard back from Brin and Page themselves, and they sold him $10,000 worth of stock at 41 cents a share, which at the time, based on its initial public offering, would have been 243,902 shares at $85 a share.
Well, that's a great story.
Yeah.
And at the time that he told me this, the stock was at $229 and would have been worth $55 million if he had kept it. And today, if he had kept it, it would be worth over $187 million. And actually, when I talk to Chaz and I say, hey, how's Google treating you? She says, Google's always been very good to us.
Yeah.
Which is one way, you know, he was able to pay for the relaunch of his show was through that money. And, you know, just to point out how ahead of the curve he is, he was, and one of his big claims to fame is that he was the first critic to ever review a little unknown filmmaker named Martin Scorsese.
I love the story about how he went to Telluride. Michael Moore told the story. He saw that everybody was going, the year that Roger and Me was coming out at Telluride, he saw that everybody was going to the Opera House to some big movie that night, and he was terrified that nobody was going to see his movie, and he went up to Roger Ebert and begged him to come to his movie. And Roger was like, yeah, 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 yeah. But he really, really sort of begged him to come. And he went to the little nugget or wherever it was, theater, and sure enough, Roger went. And Roger was the first critic to see Roger and me write the first rave review of Roger and me. Well, you know, Michael Moore is one of many filmmakers who praises Roger for giving him a career, along with Errol Morris.
This is one of those stories, though, that reminds us how things have changed, in that Roger did not review movies out of Telluride back then. When he used to go in those days, he held his reviews till the day of release. That was the tradition, and that's what Roger stuck by, as did the New York Times. The New York Times still does it to some degree at the festivals they go to, but it's a very different world than the world now where people are tweeting their comments on movies as they walk out of the theaters in Telluride in Venice and Toronto.
But even to have Roger walking around a festival saying that he likes something.
Oh, absolutely. Not saying that wasn't incredible, and he was very supportive of Michael the whole way. All those things are true, but it was like, it's a different planet we live on now. Because the thing is, when Roger loved something like that, everybody heard about it who was around him. So he was enormously influential in terms of other press and things like that. But it wasn't like he went out and wrote the review that night and it was online, you know, an hour later raving about this movie. You've got to see this movie. It's a different planet.
You know, it's like that Simpsons joke where they see the latest, I think it's Star Wars film, and the geek leaves and he's got a computer strapped to his chest and he's typing out his review already as he's walking out of the theater. But, you know, he was so ahead of his time, and, you know, it's a kind of a morbid joke at this point, but he entered, and this is Roger, of course, entered the New Yorker cartoon caption contest several times, and he won once.
He would tweet that out every single week, literally. It was something you saw in your Twitter feed, that his latest entry in the contest, and a lot of people thought, it was interesting, a lot of people thought he never won. But he did. He did win once.
He won, I guess, the contest number 281. In contest number 374, okay, which was last, you know, right, I guess it was recent, and it was the last entry, it was of a cartoon, and there is a coffin on a stage with a chef in it. And his caption was, "For burial, a companion coffin will facilitate when he takes it all with him."
Jesus.
How eerie is that?
Well, and his last review was To the Wonder, and a movie that many critics are excoriating, he was kind to.
And he should have been, but that's a whole other conversation.
But you know, we could argue some more, David. Feel free.
Yeah. Well, you know, but the other thing is that Roger's been, you know, quietly had been sick for, you know, had been in the hospital since December. So, you know, getting back to the surprise of this, I think there was a sense that, you know, unfortunately, we were getting near the end in this last number of months. But it's still a shock, I think, to people who even knew how sick he was in the last few weeks. You know, actually knowing that he's ill and having him actually go are quite different.
I would have to agree with that. And certainly, you know, there's been a plethora of I don't even have an adjective to use here for how many obituaries there have been online and of course in print. And it's especially nice that both of you would take the time to speak with us about your memories of Roger Ebert, film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, also at the movies on television.
I'm looking at his thumb right now.
That's the thing. He was just a giver. He was someone who wanted to share and he wanted to give. And he was incredibly helpful to an enormous number of people. And that's what I find the most moving about him.
And one of the hardest workers ever in anything. I mean, that was the thing. Roger worked harder than anybody. Love him, hate him, whatever you feel about his reviews. The guy lived and died, literally, unfortunately. But he lived and breathed this work. And worked harder than anybody else that's out there or has ever been out there.
I agree.
That's never going to change.
And maybe I should leave us on this note then. I remember sitting next to another Can story, sitting next to Roger Ebert, and in between Roger Ebert and Elvis Mitchell, actually. And
lucky you.
I cannot remember the year. And it was at Can in the Debussy for a screening, the first screening of Brown Bunny, Vincent Gallo's film.
God.
And it was so bad. Elvis Mitchell was talking back to the screen. Roger Ebert was talking back to the screen. He began singing "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head" for some reason. And everybody like in the row started to chime in. And after his review was published, I guess Vincent Gallo took offense.
Umbrage
and said, "Oh, who cares what that fat guy says anyway?" And Roger Ebert turned around.
Oh, it was much worse than that.
Oh, yeah. Well,
he wished cancer upon him. Oh, unfortunately.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. Well, Roger Ebert had a great comeback. He said, you know what? I won't always be. I'm paraphrasing here. He said, I'm fat now, but I won't always be fat. However, you will always be the director of Brown Bunny.
And yet, when That's Gallo great. Cut the movie, Roger was willing to look at it and willing to deal with Gallo and, say put bygones improved. Behind and gave it a good review. So go
that
figure.
That speaks volumes again.
Thank you very much, both of you. David Pollan from Movie City News and Ann Thompson from Thompson on Hollywood, the blog over at IndieWire. We'll place links to your work in the show notes. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Sperling.
Thank you.
Well, it was great of them to take the time. One thing we didn't mention, I thought the best tribute I saw online was on Huffington Post.
Written by Michael Giltz. No, I'm sorry.
No. I didn't write anything. On the front page of the Huffington Post, the very front page, they just had a photo of Roger Ebert and four stars above it. That was the headline. Just four stars. And I thought that was so elegant and classy and succinct and, so appropriate. It was just a lovely tribute to him, I thought. And such a clever headline. That's just, that really stopped me in my tracks.
You know, I thought what The Onion did was very funny. Now, The Onion is a sarcastic, I guess it parodies the news in a way. It's sarcastic news.
No, it does. Yeah.
And he says,
not in a way, it parodies the news.
Yeah. He says their headline was Roger Ebert hails human existence as a triumph.
Yeah, that was very cute. And a review of humanity that he said was basically pretty good.
Yeah. Calling the overall human experience poignant, thought-provoking, and a complete tour de force, film critic Roger Ebert praised existence Thursday as an audacious and thrilling triumph.
I hate to take issue with David Pollan when he's off the air, but, DVDs came out in 1997, and that was long before widescreen TVs became ubiquitous. And in that first year or two, some studios would still put out movies in pan and scan only on DVD, which was ridiculous. Like, at least give us the option. And that's what everybody was arguing about, and especially Roger Ebert. And they very quickly started to just present movies. They didn't even present both. They just presented movies in letterbox. On DVDs for a year or two, they said, "Oh no, people want a choice." But long before widescreen TVs came onto the market and became, the big presence that they were, it became pretty established that on DVDs you would get the actual aspect ratio of the film the way it was meant to be seen. And I think he was a big part of that. And it's absolutely true that widescreen TVs led to a lot of TV shows being letterboxed and made, established it once and for all. No question about that. But there was still a very important early period where DVDs had letterbox movies long before there were widescreen TVs. And I think Roger Ebert was one of the major reasons why. And finally, another filmmaker died this week. Another person.
Oh,
from
wow.
Movies.
You're going from death to death here, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, it's Les Blank. And I think he's appropriate to mention because he's an important documentary filmmaker. Perhaps his most famous film is Burden of Dreams, a documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo by director Werner Herzog. And you've been hearing a lot about Herzog because he was really felt indebted to Roger Ebert and really felt in the middle of his career when nobody paid attention, nobody cared about his work, he couldn't get any notices or any funding. Roger Ebert kept championing him and the films he was making, and Herzog really felt a kinship with Ebert that was very personal and real. And Les
with Ebert or Les Blank?
No, okay. To Ebert. Yeah. And Les Blank had made this movie about him. But the way that Roger Ebert championed filmmakers and championed talent and championed journalists, which he did all his career, Herzog did that as well. He has a mentor to Errol Morris, as was mentioned. And in fact, he told Errol Morris, he was dilly-dallying on his debut film, Gates of Heaven, a classic documentary, very funny. And he said, "You've got to finish this film. If you finish this film, I will eat my shoe."
That's right.
And so Errol Morris finally finished the film, and Les Blank made the documentary film, a 20-minute short, Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, in which he went on stage and with a little garlic and stuff, actually, I think it was duck or goose fat, and actually ate some of the leather of his shoe as a sort of a stunt. So, it all ties in. It's a big community where, when people are good and they try to, help others and are positive energy, it comes back for them.
Well, yes, and I would agree with you. I actually, this is another Roger Ebert story. I know we're trying to move on, but to your point, Michael, I saw You, Me, and Everyone We Know, I think is the name of the Miranda July film, her first film. And
yep.
I really,
yep.
really enjoyed it. And I knew, it was Roger Ebert who was urging me to see this film in Cannes. He urged me to see it in Sundance. I didn't get a chance. And I saw it, I emailed him and I said, "Hey, listen, you're absolutely right. That was a fantastic film. I'd love to tell the filmmaker that. He sends me her email address, CCing her. And this is Miranda July. And so I got to write a fan letter to Miranda July because of Roger Ebert. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of positivity that I think made him so well-liked and well-loved and appreciated over the years. Now, speaking of just the opposite of positivity, we have NBC.
And their late-night wars. Moving on to television.
Yes, moving on to I mean, this story, Michael, I started mentioning it when we were doing our little pre-show kind of talk beforehand. This makes me so angry. This story, not the fact that I'm not a Jay Leno fan. Not that
right.
I hate
the story is that it's official, of course, as everyone knows. Jay Leno will be, you know, have his contract dropped in the spring. Jimmy Fallon will take over the Tonight Show in the spring of 2014, right during the Olympics.
Right, and for those of you outside the country, I realize you don't get many of these shows. You don't get the Tonight Show. You don't get Late Night with Jimmy Fallon.
I think they're shown overseas. Quite a few of them.
Well, certainly, I know that the Daily Show is, and the Colbert Report is.
Well, I know Craig Ferguson is seen in Australia, and Letterman is seen in England. I think they're all seen pretty much worldwide now in different ways.
Okay, well, you know, I kind of never really hated Jay Leno, never really loved him all that much. And, you know, he was just there. But what they did, NBC, what they did the first time, I thought, was a bit of a mistake. And I understand they didn't want to lose Conan O'Brien. I get it. But this is just outright stupidity.
Well, what's the difference? They dumped Jay Leno for Conan O'Brien because they were worried about younger viewers and they didn't want to lose what they thought was the host for the next 20 years, Conan O'Brien. So they said, all right, Jay, you're going to have to step aside. He didn't want to, but he did. And they've made Conan the host of The Tonight Show. The ratings didn't work out. They asked Jay to come back. Now, again, they've got Jimmy Kimmel coming in and he's competing in the young demos, which are the only demos they care about. 18 to 34 year old males. You know, that's what they really care about. 18 to 49, if you really push them to it. But Jimmy Kimmel is competing at 11:30. He's number three in overall viewers. But nonetheless, they think, oh, my God, he's actually competing. You know, he might be doing OK. He's beating Letterman a little bit in the demos. And they're worried Jimmy Kimmel will establish himself as the late night host for the next 20 years. And so they say, we got to jump Leno and get, you know, Jimmy Fallon in here so that he can start to make his play to the kids and be the man.
Right. And they actually had a little song sung to Jimmy Fallon and Jay Leno. They did this bi-coastal. They revised the lyrics to Tonight, the West Side Story, I guess, tune. What do you call it? A song from West Side Story. And I thought it was very good and very YouTubeable. And I thought to myself, wow, if Jay Leno had only been doing this, he probably would still have the demo.
Yeah, no, I don't.
You don't think so?
Because Conan O'Brien does that demo out the wazoo, and he still doesn't get the young people. He didn't have the big numbers that he needed. So, no, that's not the truth. They like to, you know, when they hire these people, they say, oh, Jimmy Fallon may be, you know, doing just this, that, and the other thing. But look at his YouTube fans. Look at his followers on Twitter. It's like I say, look at the ratings. So what's happened? Here are the big developments. Number one, Lorne Michaels lost his battle with NBC. He's the guy who oversees Jimmy Fallon. He's the Saturday Night Live guru. And he wanted Jimmy Fallon to start in the fall of 2014. He thought the transition was too soon, and he wanted to wait for the fall. And NBC said, no, we got to get him in there now. We want to get him there during the Olympics when we can launch him with a huge audience. We want to do it now.
Right. And I would agree with Lorne Michaels. It is too soon. They just brought him back.
What do you mean, Jay Leno?
They
don't think it's too soon to dump Leno. He doesn't think it's too soon to dump Leno. He just wanted more time to prepare Fallon. He's not worried about Leno.
Oh,
he doesn't think it's unseemly. He just wanted more time to prepare for the official launch. That's all.
Well, and they're moving the show from L.A. to New York. Now, here's where I think there's a big mistake. What night show, variety, would you call this? Late night talk show, right?
Yeah.
How many of them shoot in New York and how many of them shoot in L.A.? You've got Letterman in New York. You've got The Daily Show in New York.
You've got Craig Ferguson in L.A. You've got The Tonight Show in L.A.
But not anymore.
You've got Jimmy Kimmel in L.A.
Right. You're basically giving it up to Jimmy Kimmel. The 11:30.
You're giving what up?
And what I mean is,
Where the show is filmed?
Well, it matters quite a bit when you have to book guests. It's a lot easier.
Every guest in the world goes to New York and L.A.
Well, but it's a lot easier to book out of L.A.
No, it's not. It's a lot easier to book out of New York, I'd say.
I wouldn't.
You're thinking of Hollywood only. There's a lot more people in late night than just movie stars. There's all sorts of people. There's music people. Music is a lot easier to book in New York than L.A. There's people from Europe, a lot easier to get them to New York than L.A. you're out of your mind if you think LA is the center of the world. It's the center of Hollywood and nothing else.
No, what I mean by that is in LA, there was always this, I don't want to say rivalry. When agents and booking agents book their talent onto a show, there's a big rivalry over who gets to go first.
Of course. And that doesn't change because they're in New York or LA. That's meaningless. The distance is nothing, for God's sakes.
The people I knew who worked on the late show when Letterman moved over from NBC to CBS in the mid 90s, that was always a big problem. They had to, and it wasn't the LA New York thing, it was who gets him first or who gets a guest first in New York. That was the issue.
No, it's first period. They don't, Leno and Letterman care who gets them first. They don't care whether you're in New York or L.A. Leno wants to have the guest before Letterman. Letterman wants the guest before Leno, period. They don't give a damn if it's New York or L.A. They could be in San Diego, Tuscaloosa. They want the guest first.
Hey, what are you saying about Tuscaloosa?
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And Jay Leno's been back on the air for 4 years. It may seem like yesterday, but it's been 4 years since he returned to Tonight Show. It's not too soon.
I don't know. I mean, it just seems like... I just don't like the way they handled this.
I don't think they're stupid. He's number one. They should leave him. But all they look at is the demos. Who's number one in the key demo, that 18 to 49 demo? It's Jon Stewart. He's at 1.4 million viewers in that 18 to 49 demo they care about. That's for the first quarter of 2013. Who's number two? Stephen Colbert, 1.1 million. Who's number three is Jay Leno with 1 million in that key demo. Number four, Jimmy Kimmel. He has almost a million. It's 956,000 viewers in that demo on average. Who's number five? David Letterman at 897,000 viewers in that key demo. Down at number six, Jimmy Fallon, 718,000 demos. But of course, he's an hour later than Jay Leno and David Letterman. But there you go. Leno still beats Jimmy Kimmel in that demo, but he loses to Colbert and Jon Stewart. But they say, hey, look, Jimmy Kimmel's the future. Jimmy Fallon's the future. If Jimmy Fallon is an hour earlier, he can get more viewers and, you know, make sure that Kimmel doesn't establish himself. And what does Conan get? The guy that they dumped and everybody was so angry about. He gets 597,000 viewers. That's when you include Live plus 7, which I don't think those other numbers do. So his numbers are probably even lower. So he's on TBS. Nobody even thinks about him. He did just get renewed for another year.
Right, another to 2015. Yeah.
So he a two-year deal. He got extended 1 year, essentially. And that's basically like a week-to-week contract as far as late-night talk show hosts are concerned. It's not exactly a sign of confidence in my mind.
No, I'd agree with you. I mean, but I think, you know, it's TBS. They probably don't even know if they're going to be around in 3 years.
I'm kidding.
I knew as soon as I said that I would have to recant it or you'd be all over me.
So Stewart and Colbert are the real kings of late night. And some people say Colbert is the one that should replace Letterman.
Oh, well, I don't agree with that. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but Stephen Colbert is kind of a persona. It's not who he really is. And I don't necessarily think with that kind of late night talk show, you want somebody there who's a little bit more real, not playing a character.
Well, yeah, I assume he wouldn't be playing the persona that he has right now.
Right. But have you ever seen him not play that persona?
Well, no. But
Okay, then.
Well, I'm not saying that they're suggesting he play that right-wing character as a talk show host.
Okay.
I'm saying they would just expect him to be Stephen Colbert the person.
Who do you think takes over for Jimmy Fallon over on Late Night?
Well, that's Seth Meyers as the inside track. He's from Saturday Night Live, of course. He does the Weekend Update. Lorne Michaels oversees that show as well. I don't know if anyone could ever tell the difference. Put in Seth Meyers or Jimmy Fallon, and would anybody notice there'd been a change in host? It just seems like
Probably another
SNL guy sneaking right in there. By the way, they say that Leno, you know, Colbert beats Leno, but that's because they're only looking at brand new episodes. When you look at reruns, episodes that are rerunning of the that night's show, you know, like which happens a third of the year, Leno beats Colbert.
Oh wow, okay.
So, you know, if you include reruns, and why wouldn't you? Because they count. You know, so I'm not even sure what those quarterly figures include. Do they include DVR, Live plus 3, Live plus 7? It's not quite clear what's going on there. But you would think, you know, that the fact that he beats him in reruns is kind of significant.
Well, it's, you know, you certainly don't make as much.
And you look at the lead-in he has, which is 0 from NBC.
Right.
It's even more remarkable he's number one, which is, again, why to us it makes no sense from a business point of view.
Do you think Leno goes on and does a talk show somewhere?
Why not?
Well, you know, they really felt like, look, and these are the executives at NBC, they felt, hey, you know what? Fox wouldn't take Conan 4 years ago because the affiliates went crazy and said, no, you can't put something on at 11 there. That's our news time. And that's our time that you can't take back from us. And so they're not going to give it to Leno.
Well, I'm sure they're right about that. I mean, if they couldn't get them to do it for Conan, I doubt this much later with an older act that they would be able to get them to let them do it for Leno. Though Leno was always number one, and Conan was never number one. So maybe he was hip, but maybe the affiliates, maybe something has changed in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I just don't like it when people are trying to strategize this way. I mean, look, Leno was number one. Okay, and so basically what you're saying
is...
He is number one. So basically what you're saying is, be successful, and we will fire you.
Well, eventually it's everybody steps down at some point, but I don't know why you'd be easing them out the door. It makes no sense to me.
Right, it's kind of a big deal then.
That's right.
All right, well then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We have a ton of stories to get through today, so we're going to have to do it fast. Our first story.
Ha.
And our first story is not ha. I think, Michael, what you're referring to is we can't do this fast, but we should try and prove you wrong.
All right.
The big get bigger in publishing. That's our first story. Random House is merging with Penguin, turning the Big Six into the Big Five in terms of the major publishing houses here in North America. And now Amazon has bought out Goodreads, the social site where people gather to discuss books. Goodreads fed customers to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online stores. They also competed with Amazon to see whose pages popped up first when people searched for info on a particular title. Now you can imagine Amazon will drop all the other links and make Goodreads an Amazon-only zone for the 20 million people who use it to talk about what books they're reading right now. Gee, you know, if only there was a website you could get smart, informed recommendations and maybe info on new releases. I wonder. Well, anyway, Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal in the publishing community. This was an earthquake. I mean, Goodreads was one of the last independent worlds out there that wasn't kowtowing to Amazon. So to have Amazon buy them, it's not a surprise. They own Shelfari, which was sort of a similar ID. They own part of Library Thing. And so Goodreads is the new iteration of just a community where people can gather and talk about books. But it felt like an independent voice, one of the last ones out there. And now Amazon has snapped them up. The big thing I think they want to do is to make Goodreads part of the Kindle. So you're on the Kindle, you finish your book, and it says, hey, post your review on Goodreads right now. Just fill out this box. Boom, your account gets posted on Goodreads. They just want to make it as easy as possible for you to share your love of a book and, of course, find other books to buy.
Well, here's a couple points. One, of course, Goodreads was using Amazon's data feed for some time, and they had this big row, and Amazon said, you can't use our data feed for mobile. So they had to kind of cease and desist with the data feed of their own accord. They could have continued, Goodreads, that is, but they would have been limited. So now Goodreads solved that problem. They now can use Amazon's data feed for whatever they want since they're part of the company. The other thing is, where was Barnes & Noble? This is exactly the thing, the type of thing that Barnes & Noble should have gotten involved
in.
They
don't have any money.
Yeah, what?
There's closing stores. They don't have any money to invest in Goodreads. Amazon is just, you know, they want traffic. The sites, as a book buying thing, it may not even necessarily be the best thing, but they can get the 20 million people to link into the Amazon ecosystem, and that benefits them in a lot of ways.
Well, they stop sending me emails every 5.5 minutes?
I wonder how much they paid for it. The estimates ranged from $100 million to $1 billion, which is clearly on the high end. But who knows? It was certainly a lot of money.
Yes, that is true. Now, we just talked about being number one, right? In your demo and in your time slot. But when is being number one not such a big deal? When you're American Idol, of course. It's easily the number one show on Fox. In fact, it's the number one and number two shows on Fox, thanks to airing on Wednesdays and Thursdays. But the constant barrage of other singing competition shows like The X Factor and especially The Voice are taking their toll. Ratings are down 30% to 40% in total audience figures from last season when the show was dethroned by Sunday Night Football. It's still solidly ranked in the top 10, but overnight figures in the key 18 to 49 demo, there's that demo again, they hit an all-time low, lower than any episode since the show debuted as a summer series back in June of 2002. And what singing show is ranked ahead of it? The Voice. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's been coming for 2 years now, 3 years, obviously. It was number one for 8 years in a row. That's astonishing. Clearly, that could not last forever. It's still in the top 10, but, you know, there's no question it has fallen and fallen hard. To see The Voice ranked ahead of it, that hurts. That's got to really hurt.
Well, now, speaking of The Voice, NBC has virtually nothing to boast about except football and its singing competition. So executives are deeply relieved that the new spring edition debuted with even higher ratings than the fall edition and is sure to win its night in the key 18 to 49 demos, beating the older skewing Dancing with the Stars. That might be because, you know, The Voice has two new hosts on it or two new judges. Two factors had them worried. They were double pumping the show with a new edition just weeks after the last one ended, and those two judges had taken a break. But Shakira and Usher, those two new judges, they slipped right in while Blake Shelton and Adam Levine maintained continuity. The Voice averaged 13.4 million viewers, and NBC is back in the game on Mondays and Tuesdays. So big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. Big success for them. Thank God it didn't blow up in their face. But, you know, long term, I think they're going to burn the show out a lot quicker. You know, that's just not going to be as big a show as it might have been because you keep doing it every 6 months. People get sick of it. Also, Revolution, the show that follows The Voice, that was their big hope from the fall. That was the show they touted as the best new drama, doing really good. That has fallen apart. That's losing like 40 to 50% of their lead-in from The Voice. So that is a failure any way you shake it. There's still a network that's propped up by two shows, football and The Voice, and that's not nearly enough.
Well, now, is Hulu up for sale? Rumors swirl that Disney and News Corp are shopping the Hulu streaming service around. Potential buyers taking a look are Amazon, of all people, which would use Hulu to add tons of content to its Kindle Fire and Amazon Prime services, and AOL, which needs to get into the streaming video business in a big way. Reuters blithely says Hulu would cost, about $1 billion, you know, give or take. One player has bid $500 million for the site. That's Peter Chernin, formerly of Fox, which is a far cry from the $2 billion it was valued at just a few years ago. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I say it's a big whoop.
What?
Well, because nothing's happened.
Okay, that's true.
It's rumors swirling. More importantly, I ain't buying Hulu unless I got like a 20-year contract with all four major networks. What's the point of Hulu unless you've got locked-in deals for the major shows from the major networks? Otherwise, it's worth bupkis.
That is true. And bupkis, converted to dollars, everybody knows, is like $3.
Or one Bitcoin.
Ooh, good point. Now, the Oliviers. These are the British Theatre Awards. They have been announced for this year. Big winners in the nominees include the... And so, big winners in the nominees. You see what we did there?
I do.
Okay. They include the adaptation of the best-selling novel about autism, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. That is one title. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The Imelda Staunton revival of Sweeney Todd, a mounting of the Astaire Rogers musical Top Hat, and a clutch of plays including Lucy Prebble's The Effect and Nick Payne's Constellations. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's great because you get a sense that the shows are going to cross over to New York because last season, one of the big shows nominated at the Oliviers was Matilda, and now here they are coming to Broadway. So you know you're going to see some performances and stuff like Mark Rylance and Twelfth Night. He got a great nomination. He'll probably come to New York with that Shakespearean production. And more importantly, you see shows like The Bodyguard, a musical version of the movie, God Help Us All. That got just one or two obligatory nods. And the Spice Girl musical got none. So there still is a God.
And he doesn't like Spice Girl. He or she doesn't like Spice Girls.
Exactly.
Well, you know, that play that I mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago, The Nether by Jennifer
yes.
Haley. Susan Orlean went to see it and tweeted about it and said she loved it.
Oh, really? There you go.
There you go, yeah.
You follow Susan Orlean, the writer, the nonfiction writer?
No, actually, I don't.
Okay.
I just kind of stumbled across it. Okay, so now let's move to China, sort of. The Transformers reboot will star Mark Wahlberg, not Shia LaBeouf, because, you know, he's no longer acting in theater or films, as we know. But you can imagine how easily it might have been, you know, Jackie Chan, a huge hit series in China. The film is tailoring itself to the Chinese market. The Hollywood Reporter announced that the film's producers are partnering with the China Movie Channel to help it find locations to film in China. Promotional duties, perhaps post-production, and even cast Chinese actors in key roles. Probably villains. This follows the news that Iron Man...
Ouch.
I'm kidding! Obviously!
That's North Koreans.
Oh, that's true. Everybody knows that. Anyway, it follows the news that Iron Man 3 will have a special cut for China that includes a cameo by Fan Bingbing, a major Chinese action star, as well as other China-related elements. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
What? Okay.
One movie, tail wagging dog. It's a little silly. You know, it's not going to work for most films. It's not some big trend. You're not going to have Chinese actors in every role in every film. It's just a little blip in an action franchise that's kind of nonsense anyway.
Well, here's this story about Disney and all these layoffs. Apparently, when you pay $1 billion for something, you want things done your way. Disney is shutting down a division of the George Lucas Empire, namely the games division LucasArts. It's hardly a shocker since LucasArts never became much of a force in gaming and had become practically moribund in recent years. Tomb Raider and Lara Croft and other Indiana Jones-style games have been, you know, they've proven blockbuster franchises, whereas the LucasArts spin on the movies, you know, they weren't so hot. They proved flat. The recent fun Lego games based on indie, done by an outside company. Ditto, the many attempts at Star Wars, by the way. This doesn't mean more games won't happen, just that Disney wants them done, you know, right. And cleaning house is the first place to start. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I think it was obvious. We could see it coming. LucasArts was not an important division of Lucas anymore. They really hadn't done a lot of great stuff in recent years. They never really had a big success in video games. So I think it was just a matter of time. This is the sort of downsizing that makes sense when you bring in a new division and you feel like they're not working creatively. That's where it does make sense to say, hey, and not that Disney has a great video game division, but hey, this is not working for us. Not an important part of what we bought. Let's just clean that up and look at this whole video game world fresh.
And while we're at it, you know what? Let's fire some of our own employees because, you know what? We had a record year of growth. We're at an all-time high. We need to clean house because otherwise, how are we going to keep up the growth strategy here? We need more profit.
Yeah, it's bizarre. After this story, there were other reports about more layoffs at Disney. I mean, the company is at an all-time high in their stock. They had a great year of growth, and they're firing people left and right. It's like, well, when would you ever... Do all companies hate employees? They're like, if only get rid of these employees. They're so annoying.
Well, but there's, you know, they're trying to get rid of legacy costs and you know, pensions and a whole bunch of stuff. And
They want everybody to be outsourced. They'd love it if every employee was freelance.
Yeah, because then there's
except
no
for the top executives.
Yeah. What kills me is I watched them make so much money at Disneyland alone last week that in the midst of all of this, to get this email from the Hollywood Reporter saying that they're going to be, you know, laying off employees. Now, I had been told a while back, maybe 3-4 weeks ago, that this was going to come down, that they're about to lay people off. But I don't want to say skeptical, but I didn't want to say anything until after it was publicized. And it still is a bit kind of, I don't want to say, what's the right word? Just seems, it doesn't
bizarre.
Seem, yeah.
Well,
exactly.
When you're this big a company, there's probably always areas where you have some fat and you have some extra layers of corporate level that you don't need. That's true. But it's bizarre when a company is firing on all cylinders and all they ever seem to want to do is fire people.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like DreamWorks. I've beaten them into the ground. DreamWorks Animation, for them firing their employees, that makes zero sense. I mean, I don't know what the proper level of employee staffing is there, but it's clear that they're getting rid of some employees with a lot of creativity and the future franchises that they might have had, and they're dumping them. So it just doesn't make sense. Normally, you clamp down and you get rid of that fat when you're in hard times. When things are going great is when you're usually paying people more money and hiring people.
You know, I've been pushing this next idea, for a while now, and it's finally come true. The Netflix model of access to movies and TV shows for a monthly fee is coming to books, and it's happening in France, a country that has been slow to adapt ebooks, but is now quite innovative, apparently. The service is called Youbooks, and it's Youbooks.
Because apparently Books was taken.
Right.
Books.
Yeah. It was taken by a company that allowed you to post your own book so that other people could read about it, but only if your book was about tiny little kittens and cats.
Okay.
Anyway, Youbooks lets you read books while you're online, on the web, or on your tablet. And just like some introductory music streaming service, it's free. You see a banner ad across the top, and that's it. Access to books and comics in the Youbooks library, it's free. Pay about $13 a month, and you can get rid of that banner and read on your own tablet even when you're offline. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think Netflix for books makes so much sense. I think it's only a matter of time. I guess it's called the library system in a way. You know, we've got the library system already, but it's a service. And I think there's a market for it. And I think you can get people to pay a monthly fee and get regular access to books. I think it's a part of the piece of the puzzle. I think it's inevitable.
Owning your own media is so 20th century. Major studios send about 20 million takedown notices a month to Google. Just a few. Those are the automated, we think someone is stealing our movies warnings that try and eliminate links to pirated material. Just keeping up with them is a laborious and expensive procedure, one made more annoying by the fact that the studios are doing everything from sending takedown notices to themselves to people like us who are posting clips the studios themselves provided and lots of other nonsense. Can you tell I'm a little annoyed at that, by the way?
I can.
Yeah, okay. Now it turns out that the studios are sending out takedown notices over their own takedown notices. Okay, that just proves how stupid this is. Hey, Google, get rid of our notices telling you to get rid of links to pirated material. We don't want those online. There are two possibilities. One, the studios are idiots and the automated systems don't know what they're doing.
I'm putting my money on that one.
Two, the studios suddenly realized that the takedown notices themselves were a perfect way for some smart coder to find an up-to-date listing of pirated websites and create the most effective search engine for illegal material in the world. Yes, the studios are in essence shining a spotlight on websites and say, hey everyone, they've got Game of Thrones over here. Whoops. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I think. It's just another ridiculous quirk in this whole system that proves how poorly it's working.
The special effects house Rhythm and Hughes, you know, we've talked about them. They filed for bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were bought at a bankruptcy auction by Prana Studios, another special effects house focused on animation. Prana did the low-budget Hoodwinked. You probably saw it, Michael.
And I interviewed the filmmakers.
Well, there you go. And now they own Rhythm and Hughes. And they do a lot of straight-to-DVD product for Disney and have graduated to their biggest project to date, the Cars spinoff called Planes. Oh, geez, I just got out of Cars Land, which, by the way, is a great little section of...
Oh yeah, it's nice?
It's really amazing. They did a great job on that, I have to admit.
Wow.
That was pretty slick. Anyway, Rhythm and Hughes is the special effects house that symbolizes the broken system of visual effects these days that's in place throughout the industry. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal. It's unbelievable. I think this typifies everything. It's like what we're talking about with Disney and DreamWorks. The major studios want top-notch special effects from highly trained professionals with this unique skill set that makes their movies popular and hugely successful all over the world, but they don't want to pay for it. They don't want in-house special effects. They don't want to book these companies long-term. They don't want to pay them so much that they can have a long-term budget and salaries. They want to budget themselves poorly, and they want to have last-minute top-notch, but cut-rate deals for every single movie they make. It's just crazy.
Yes, well, I've always said, haven't I, that the studios, they basically, it's not a monopoly, but it sure is close.
Why wouldn't a studio have bought Rhythm and Hughes? I mean, they need the in-house special effects for half their movies.
Why do you want that overhead? I mean, Sony has a problem trying to make that overhead work with the Sony Imageworks. Nobody wants that overhead.
Why? Because they're in such demand. Couldn't they just use them for their own works and market them out for the others?
It's unnecessary overhead.
Especially, well, what do you mean unnecessary? Their movies depend on special effects.
You can farm that out.
They don't even need stars anymore. We need special effects.
You can farm that out, and then you don't have to worry about it.
But you can't. That's the whole point. You can't farm it out. They keep going out of business. You can't farm it out and not pay them any money and expect good quality work. That's the whole point. They want the special effects, but they don't want to pay for it.
You say,
we'll farm it out, and then you don't have to pay anybody a salary or benefits or a pension or anything.
Sometimes they go out of business and someone new shows up. Sometimes that winds up hurting them, as we're going to talk about during our listener email.
All right.
Well, Netflix made another high-powered acquisition. It has greenlit a 10-episode miniseries from the Wachowski siblings. You might, I almost said brothers there. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I almost said brothers,
but now it's a brother and a sister.
That's right.
Lana and Andrew Wachowski will oversee and write and even direct some episodes of Sense8, a sci-fi series about the convergence of humanity and technology, which kind of describes, you know, all science fiction, frankly, and especially The Matrix, which they directed as well. It's going to air in late 2014 and will include their collaboration on the scripts with Babylon 5 creator J. Michael Straczynski. His participation alone is enough to get a lot of sci-fi fans excited. No word yet on casting or what exactly it's about. I think it's about somebody who's stuck inside a computer and sees lots of green code going up and down the screen.
Keep going.
Okay. Knowing their secrecy, we may not get a clearer idea until the 10 episodes are aired, posted, streamed, or whatever you call it these days. But what do you call it, actually, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Because they haven't made a good movie since The Matrix.
That's, you know, kind of true.
1999. It's been 14 years. They've done Speed Racer, Cloud Atlas, the two disastrous Matrix sequels. They produced and wrote V for Vendetta. They have had a bad track record. They had one, you know, big moment. I like Bound, a little film they made before that. But they've had one big cultural moment, and everything since then has been a serious downward slope.
That is very true. Now, speaking of downward slopes, I was actually, this is how meta my life is. I was online for the ride, the Finding Nemo adventure ride at Disneyland, ooh, which is in the submarine. Basically, they just changed the name of
they repurposed the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Right, precisely. They already had the submarines and a big pool of water, so why
look,
not
it's
just
the Lost City of Atlantis. I mean, it's Dory.
Right, exactly. And I'm sitting there, and my phone goes off, and it's an email coming to the iPhone there from the Hollywood Reporter telling me that the Finding Nemo sequel has a name. That's how meta my life is.
And tell us more.
Well, Pixar, the studio that loftily denounced sequelitis originally and consistently delivered blockbuster animated films, you know, that were not based on pre-existing books or fairy tales or TV shows and yet delivered blockbuster numbers and rave reviews, not sequels, remember? They have announced another sequel. It's been in the works for a while, but the sequel to Finding Nemo, which reigned for a while as Pixar's biggest hit, is now titled, get this, Finding Dory. The Ellen DeGeneres character.
Makes sense.
So that, yeah, it means that the character voiced by Ellen will be front and center. But of course, that character couldn't remember anything, so you could see how she could get lost, right?
That's true.
Yeah. For those keeping track, that means Pixar has now done 3 Toy Story movies, 2 Cars movies, and a spinoff, Planes, 2 Monster Inc. movies, and now 2 Finding Nemo movies. They also have a string of typically original movies, including one set inside the brain and another based on the holiday, The Day of the Dead. And of course, you have to, no studio is complete without a dinosaur flick.
Yeah, those are all in the works.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. It's kind of sad how many sequels they're making, frankly. It doesn't seem like a logical sequel. I guess if you wrote a script and thought it was so amazing you wanted to make it, okay. But in fact, it seems more like the sequel idea came first and then the script came second. And what I find bizarre is that of all these movies, all these Pixar films, the one that was burning to be a sequel is The Incredibles.
That's true. Yeah.
And why is that the one they haven't made? The one that is so easy to make a sequel for? The one that deserves a sequel? Up? No. Finding Nemo? Not really. Monsters, Inc.? I could do without. But The Incredibles? It's perfect.
I got to tell you, you know, these films, these Pixar films in California Disney Adventure or Disney's California Adventure Land or whatever, that park, they have a Pixar parade. There is a Cars Land and a Bugs Land.
Reach for the skies.
They don't have a Toy Story Land. I don't know why. But I'll tell you, Cars Land was fantastic. It is in the California Adventure Park. They have this like wilderness camp where you get to climb on logs and there's big trees and they make it like a quest, like you're in a scout troop. And
cool.
Russell is guiding you from up. And I'm thinking, really? They even worked in Russell from Up?
Good for them. No stone left unturned.
Unbelievable. In any case, that kind of actually wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we aren't going to disappoint. These stories definitely have the entertainment industry buzzing. And they definitely will be affecting our listeners, possibly, potentially, down the line.
All right. Tell me, what is it?
So, you remember we talked about, well, initially we talked about Arrow, which was not the...
Is that how you say it? Arrow
no,
or Aereo?
It's Aereo. We mispronounced it the first couple times we mentioned it. But this is the company that Barry Diller invested in that kind of puts these little teeny micro antennas all over the place and allows, at least in New York, allows you to get over-the-air broadcast television streamed through the internet to your computer or to your mobile phone. But it has a little micro antenna for every single subscriber. So it's like a little tiny remote rabbit ears in a way.
Right. They're saying their over-air television is available to anybody for free.
Right.
And they're worked out a way to make it available to you easily so that you can get access to it on your computer or your mobile device.
Right.
Your tablet or your phone. Here you go. It's free. It's over the air. You should have the right to access it. Everybody can. You buy a TV, put up rabbit ears. You got it. So New York's a little tricky with the antenna. And so they came up with this system to let you do that. So where's the problem?
Well, you kind of knew that the broadcasters, NBC, CBS, ABC, they broadcast networks, and not ESPN.
But they don't make money from over the air, so why would they care? I mean, their whole business model for so many years was just sending it out. People put up their TVs and watched it. What's the difference if it's on a tablet or a TV?
Ah, funny you should ask that question. Well, back in the day, you know, about 10 years ago, you were allowed to charge MVPDs, these multi-video service providers, these MSOs.
I don't know what that means. What are you talking about? Cable companies?
Cable companies. Satellite companies.
Speak English.
So if you're ESPN, you get to turn around and say, hey, you want our network? Yeah, well, that's nice. Listen, you got to pay us $3 per...
Well, of course they did. That's a cable channel. Of course they have... of course they can pay.
Right.
Of course they can say you got to... They don't give away their product for free. They're allowed to. But over-the-air networks are given free broadband and allowed to transmit their signals all over the country. And in exchange, they're free.
That's right. They're given free spectrum.
Right.
Now... That said, well, I guess it's not free. They'd have to give it up. But that said, broadcast networks began to charge retransmission fees.
So if a cable company wanted to provide it over a line, instead of over the air, people picking them up with their antennas, if you wanted to show it on your satellite network or your cable company, you had to pay money because you weren't just a customer, wasn't himself catching the signal over the air. They were paying for it through a cable company or satellite service.
That is right.
And so they said, you got to pay us. And they said, okay. But now Barry Diller says, I don't have to pay you. We're doing over the air.
Right. Now, of course, networks said, wow, we really like this extra money that we're getting for basically, you know, I don't want to say nothing, but
it's found money.
It's found money. And guess what? Everybody has to have a cable subscription. It's really the only way to watch television these days. Well, apparently not. Not anymore. There's companies like Aereo showing up with their little mini antennas. And the broadcaster sued over copyright infringement, saying, you can't do that. That's a public display of our you're publicly displaying our work. You can't do that. It's not a private display. And court way back in November said, yeah, no, that's not true. We're going to deny this injunction. Well, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, yeah, no, actually, in this 2-1 decision, we're going to say that Aereo subscriber controls the TV stream, not Aereo. So it's actually just a long antenna. That's all it is. So
the studio sued and said, hey, we want to stop you from offering this service until we go to trial. And they said, no, we're denying your injunction. And they also said, you have a pretty weak case.
Right. Aereo doesn't need to license this content. That's exactly what the Second Circuit said. Now, it was a 2-1 decision. And I have to say, I don't know Judge Denny Chin personally, but
he's the dissenter.
He's the dissenter and needs a little bit of a lesson in technology because as GigaOhm wrote, they blasted Aereo's service as a quote-unquote sham and a quote-unquote a Rube Goldberg-like contrivance over-engineered in an attempt to avoid the reach of the Copyright Act and to take advantage of a perceived loophole in the law, end quote. Now, first of all, it's not a perceived loophole. It is the law, and it is the loophole. You know, it's not a loophole.
Well, they're charging for something that people initially got over the air for free all on their own.
Right. And if you basically want to take your over the air signal off, you can do it, but you also have to give up your spectrum.
But I'm saying consumers used to get it for free, and now this company is inserting itself as a middleman so that people can get access to it on their tablet or their computer, laptop, or whatever.
That is correct. Yes.
Because there's new technology around and there's a new need for this.
But I also think Judge Chin does not understand what a Rube Goldberg-like contrivance is.
Because a Rube Goldberg device is something very complicated to do something very simple.
Right, exactly. And basically, this is something that is just a giant, long extension cord for an antenna. That's all this is.
Just lots of little antennas. It's not complicated. It's very simple, is what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, it's all done in a very thoughtful way.
So why do people care?
Well,
most people are never going to buy Aereo. Why do they care?
Well, because a lot of people are frustrated with these cable bundles, right? And so
I had friends last night. I was at a dinner party. We were having breakfast for dinner. We had pancakes. They were delicious. And we watched the new season premiere of Mad Men.
Don't tell me what happens. Don't tell me what happens.
I won't tell you what happens. Okay. Believe me, I don't care.
I have to collect 12 of them before I start watching.
And all the discussion was about cutting the cord. One person saying, I don't watch sports. I don't watch most new TV shows. I'm going to cut the cord.
Well, actually, our listener, Raul, actually has a hole on our Facebook page over at Facebook. On the Showbiz Sandbox Facebook page, Raul posted this story called Broadcasters Worry About Zero TV Homes. And those are the people that don't have a TV at all, or they, you know.
Right. This is like this person. Yeah. Well, they have TV. They just don't have, cable or satellite.
Some don't even have TV, but yeah.
Oh, well, they don't have the physical. Well, they might have, they have a screen. It might be a computer screen or whatever, a flat screen, but they don't get TV. Okay.
Right. So you're asking like, why is it important? A lot of people are saying, well, it doesn't really matter. This was just an injunction ruling. But the ruling was written, as you said, Michael, like a final opinion. And really this key issue of whether Aereo is a public or private performance, they're basically saying, look, it's private. It's not public. There has to be an antenna for every subscriber.
All right, but most people aren't going to get Aereo. So is the big deal the fact that people, the cable companies or the major networks or other people start to offer more flexibility, letting you watch on your tablet and your phone, not maybe just in your home, frankly? But
that's what the MSOs are hoping because, you know, they don't like these bundles at all, supposedly. That's what they say. And they're
saying, an MSO?
A cable provider.
Well, what do you mean? They do the bundling.
They do the bundling because they have.
Oh, they don't like the bundling. No, when you talk bundling, I thought you meant where I've got to buy my cable service and basically my phone and Wi-Fi from one person, and it's a monopoly.
Correct.
And if you don't buy 150 channels, they bundle all the time, so they can't complain about it. Because when I buy my cable service, I got to buy 170 channels, so they can't turn around and say I hate it when ESPN makes me take ESPN3 because they tell me to take it all. So what choice? You know, they can't bitch about that.
Right. And a lot of people are saying, hey, look, the broadcasters have these retransmission agreements that go out 3-4 years, but it gives the cable companies a lot more leverage when they are negotiating with these retransmission rights. So instead of paying $3 for ESPN, maybe the cable company will have to pay $2. Now, will that savings?
Why would that go down? Why would Aereo make the ESPN royalty rate go down?
Well, because people will start, as you say, cutting the cord.
But then they won't have access to ESPN.
Then they don't want
that
access.
Makes ESPN even more valuable. I mean, that's you know.
Well, they might
ESPN's
not want.
ESPN's not going to go down in value because somebody cuts the cord.
They may not want access. They may say, "Hey, you know what? I really like AMC. I never watch sports."
That's a very small group of people. I want sports, so I'm not going to dump my cable provider until I can get access to the YES Network, which is the Yankees, and Turner Classic Movies, and ESPN, and all these other channels. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to stop watching live sports. So that's not going to affect me in the least, and it's not going to make it cheaper just because some person who never watches sports cuts their cable bill and, you know, gets rid of their service. That's not going to make ESPN even less valuable to me. No. I don't see why Alisa getting rid of her cable provider is going to suddenly make ESPN less valuable.
What about Spike TV? Do you want Spike TV?
I don't care about it. You know, I think bundling in general is, I like the fact that you get 700 channels. I like that personally.
Yeah, a lot of people
I
don't.
I think it's good. I know that a lot of people don't, but I think they don't realize that suddenly, oh, they're watching a show on FX that they never knew about. Oh, there's a show on the Cooking Channel. Oh, what's this on History Channel? I never watched the History Channel, but suddenly they've got Vikings on Sunday night and I want to watch that. So I'm not a big person that's upset about it. I just hate how expensive it is. You know, I think it's wildly over expensive. But hey, I like live sports. I watch a lot of television. I don't mind that I get 700 channels at once. I think it's fine. Most people say, oh, I would just want to pick and choose. They pretty much soon find out that they're picking and choosing a lot of channels.
Well, there's a lot of cable cutting going on, or a lot of people choosing not to have a TV service, a cable service.
Well, there's not a lot. We've never seen a lot.
Well, Nielsen, and that's what the story from Raul says. It says that, you know, effectively, it's 5 million, I think it is. I can't remember. Uh-huh. 5 million of those residences, these zero TV residences, is up from 2 million in 2007. So it's headed in the wrong direction, at least.
And they're all kids. They're all young people. Those
That's
crazy
right.
kids who think, I've got Netflix. I don't need TV.
I was actually in San Francisco a couple weeks back, and I overheard, I was eavesdropping on this conversation between what looked like two 20-somethings. And one of them was saying that, no, they don't have a cable. They don't have satellite. They just have this PS3. It was a young girl. And I thought to myself, you do not look like the person that would have a PS3, let alone know how to actually hook it up and get like Hulu or whatever it is you're trying to get on that thing. But
Sexist.
She just didn't look like it.
Sexist.
Ah, brother. So, we should probably move on then, shouldn't we, to our listener email.
I'd say so. But so it's there are cord nevers, people who cut the cord and never had a cord in the first place.
Right.
I don't think they're ever going to be a huge part of the thing until there's a lot more accessibility to all the sports and live programming and channels that you don't have right now.
That may be true. Mm-hmm. Well, now our listener email this week to dirt@showbizsandbox.com comes from James Gardner out of Australia. His website, Cinetech Geek, is all about digital cinema and what goes on in the projection booth and in movie theaters, the technology of movie theaters. And he wanted, he writes, "Hello, Team Sandbox. Wanted to bring this to your attention." He has two stories here, one about Deluxe, which is a motion picture laboratory. Their Australian division is shutting down, so no more 35 millimeter film prints being processed and printed in Australia from Deluxe.
So they'll have to ship them from overseas if they're showing actual physical films in Australia?
I think the latter is true. If they're actually showing physical 35 millimeter film prints, which they are doing less and less, thus the reason for closing down the film lab.
Okay. And the other story?
In fact, you know who else is closing down their lab? Peter Jackson's Park Road post-production facility is also closing. And that's we have a link to that story as well from
what James
Gardner.
What did they do?
They are a post-production lab, so I would assume...
For film only, or for digital, or for special effects, or...
Oh, I would assume for all
I mean, Weta is the New Zealand special effects company. So this is a separate company that does post-production, and that's usually like, it's not making prints like Deluxe. What do they do?
Well, it's a film laboratory, so it's 35 millimeter prints.
Oh, okay. So there's just no business anymore for 35 millimeter prints. Well, what did James have to say about that?
Well, he just wanted us to know about it. He says, "This is a significant and historic change coming for cinema. I'm surprised you guys have not covered it in any way. I've tried to prepare the industry by producing a series of videos on the subject directed at cinema owners in an attempt to make sure as few of them as possible become victims of this change." And he provides links to all of his series of end of film series, as he's calling it.
And you've watched them and they're pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically going through explaining why film is ending. You know, really why film is ending. You know, those studios we were talking about, Michael?
Yeah.
You know, they're so penny pinching and, you know, they're always trying to get out of paying for something. Well, they got out of paying for film, but they didn't get out of paying for it on their time. They, you know, they basically ran Fuji and Agfa and Kodak out of business, and now they have no film.
So we're talking about film. We mean physical 35 millimeter film.
Right,
That the exhibition of where you put a piece of film and pass light through it and screen it, that's ending.
Right. I mean, and Fuji is out of business. They don't make film anymore. Agfa has been out of business. They don't make film anymore, at least this kind of film. Fuji may make some kind of like archival film, but it's not print stock. And Kodak is only going to be operating at 10 to 15% of its capacity.
So why are we seeing this in Australia? Or is this happening all over the world?
It's happening
all over the world. These post-production companies are shutting down.
These labs, they're all shutting down, or at least they're transitioning into digital. So this just happens to be from Australia. It's definitely happening all over the world.
So in his second video, James says, "Why film for exhibition is ending in the next 1 to 2 years."
I will say this. He might be a few years off by that. And I don't mean, it's going to end in 4 years. I mean, it's going to end in a couple months.
Really?
I would not be shocked if at the end of this year, it becomes increasingly more difficult to get a film.
So essentially, studios releasing movies now, they couldn't do it even if they wanted. You couldn't get 3,000 or 4,000 prints made up anymore, right? And have them all over the world. You just, the ability to get that done with the post-production houses and the film production houses are shutting down, there's nowhere to go to get it done anymore.
That's right, because the economies of scale aren't there, the film stock, the negative isn't there. It's a big pain in the neck.
Once it stops, it just goes off a cliff, doesn't it? Once you start to slide down, it just, boom, it's over with.
Right. I mean, the studios, I remember more than the one head of distribution has said to me, "You know, we thought we could control the film cutoff. We would be in charge and in control of when we said, okay, that's it. No more films. You have to go digital." Well, it turns out the film stock companies are in charge of it.
So if you're looking at this weekend's box office, we're in North America. Evil Dead was number one. G.I. Joe was number two. The Croods were number three. Jurassic Park. All these movies, how many of them are being shown with physical film stock? Like, how many of them are actually showing a movie on film as opposed to a digital presentation?
No more than 25%.
Well, but... Well,
and I think that's high.
How could that end in 3 or 4 months? I mean, what those theaters that are the 25% of theaters that are left, what's, are those individual screens at a multimedia house? Or are they standalone theaters, or what's going on?
Well, I can't answer that. I mean, I think some of them are theaters that couldn't convert. Some of them are only half converted theaters. Effectively, it's the people that have not converted. They're smaller.
They're still one out of four theaters is like that in North America.
I think it's less than that in North America. I wouldn't be shocked if they're up to 85-90% already with the digital conversion. I know it's 75% worldwide, but that includes parts of Asia and Europe and Russia and China that have not converted yet.
To say by the end of this year, forget it. If you're a movie theater and you don't have digital projection, you're not going to be able to get a print.
It's
so
going to be
you're
very
out of
hard.
Business.
Yeah, and you will probably have to pay for it.
So, and you're getting less money for it, and it's more expensive, and so it's a nightmare.
Yeah, and some of the people that I work with and negotiate on the studios negotiate with the studios for virtual print fees. Basically, the distribution executives are saying, "Look, we hate to say this, but convert or die."
Well, yeah. So it's the end of film,
right?
You simply, even if you shoot on film, the cases where you get to actually see a movie shot and displayed in film are going to be MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, specialized little art houses and museums around the world. As a regular thing for moviegoers, it's gone.
Correct, yes.
It's probably been a while since you saw a film displayed in movie. I know the last one I did was The Master. Maybe that'll be the last film I saw, a new release, shown in actual film stock. It was 70mm and looked gorgeous.
Yeah, well, and that was a show print, so yeah, absolutely.
So how long will people be able to hear Showbiz Sandbox on digital?
Well, I think we're sending some of our episodes out into space.
So, they'll be there going out into the universe forever.
Correct.
And if aliens want to contact us, what do they do?
Well, they can email us like James did to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Planet Earth is where you want to send that. Also, you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can always subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are given away for free. You can find us, all those podcast aggregators. We actually urge you to rate and review the shows on any one of those podcast distribution platforms because it does help us out. Links to all of the shows we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Showbizsandbox.com is also where you'll find all those ways to contact us or subscribe to us. You can even follow us. We have a Twitter account, which is showbizsandbox, or @showbizsandbox if you want to speak in tweet language. We're also on Facebook, where Raul posted that story about the TV Zeros, or Zero TVers. I can't remember.
Thanks for sending that in.
Yes, thank you. And you can find us, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. They're also going out on tour, so you might want to look them up. They may be coming to your area soon. Michael has a website. This week, Michael's website is?
TwoThumbsUp.com.
Ooh, pretty interesting. Okay, well, if you can't find, Roger Ebert's estate hasn't sued Michael and you can't find his writing there, try MichaelGiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Little programming note, we will not have an episode next week because
this is news to me.
Because of CinemaCon, I meant to do this at the head of
the
show.
He's making news even as we speak.
That's right. Okay.
Now everybody's turned off because it's a four-hour episode, and at the very end you say, oh no, I told you on that episode it was at hour 7 that I mentioned the fact that we're not doing a show next week. That's two out of the last 4 weeks, Berlin. Where are you going?
CinemaCon in Las Vegas.
All right.
So until 2 weeks from now, play nice.